Chapter 18 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 18. Just after finishing the writing of the last chapter, I happened to have a conversation with Mr. Arthur Newton, the solicitor who defended Alfred Taylor, who was charged at the same time as Oscar Wilde. I had not seen Mr. Newton for at least 16 years. He reminded me of what I had completely forgotten, that I sent him £50 to defend Alfred Taylor. Taylor was never a friend of mine, indeed I scarcely knew him, and in the course of the evidence given against Wilde it was established, more or less accidentally, and, as I imagine, to the chagrin of the counsel who was prosecuting Wilde, that I had never been in his rooms in Great College Street. I felt sorry, not being English, that Taylor should be left as he was, in prison, quite penniless, unfriended and undefended. So I sent Mr. Newton a cheque and asked him to do the best he could for Taylor with such a small sum. No doubt if this fact had been within the knowledge of Robert Ross, it would have been brought up against me at the time of the trial of the ransom libel action as an example of my innate depravity, when it would, doubtless, have furnished Lord Darling with another convenient stick to beat me with, in the interests of impartial justice. But, as it happens, this dark deed has remained in obscurity to this day, when I make a present of it to those whom it may concern. Oscar was about 3 weeks in prison at Holloway before he came up for trial at the Old Bailey before Mr. Justice Charles. The day before the trial came on, I left the country, because I was asked to do so by Sir Edward Clarke, who said that my presence in London was prejudicial to his client. As a matter of fact, if he had called me as a witness, as I implored him to do even at this late hour, he would, in all probability, have saved Oscar. I declined to leave except at the direct request of Oscar himself, and he, poor man, being entirely in the hands of his legal advisers, urgently begged me, both by letter and by word of mouth, to go. He thus, without knowing it, of course, threw away his last chance of acquittal. I went to Calais and stayed at the Terminus Hotel of the Gare Maritime. From there, on or about the third day of the trial, I telegraphed to Sir Edward Clarke, giving him certain information which I implored him to use, although it was compromising to myself, and again offering to give evidence. In reply, I got a stern rebuke from Wilde's solicitors, who informed me that my telegram was most improper, and that Sir Edward Clarke had been greatly upset by receiving it. I was solemnly adjured not to attempt any further interference, which could only have the effect of rendering Sir Edward's task still harder than it is already. In my own mind, I have not the slightest doubt that if I had given evidence, Oscar would have got off. As it was, the jury disagreed, and he was sent back to prison to await another trial. An application was then made to a judge in chambers for bail, which in common justice ought to have been granted by the magistrate in the first place. This time bail was granted, and my brother Percy, then Lord Douglas of Howick, and afterwards 9th Marquess of Queensbury, went bail for Oscar. The other bail was a clergyman of the Church of England, Mr. Stuart Headlam. There can be no harm in mentioning now that my brother had to guarantee Mr. Headlam against loss, as, if Oscar had bolted, as he might have done, Headlam would have been completely ruined. So my brother made himself responsible for the whole sum, £3,000. I immediately wrote to my brother and begged him to tell Oscar that he was at liberty to go if he would and could. My brother replied that he sincerely hoped that Wilde would go, and that he was quite prepared to stand the racket. Frank Harris made elaborate arrangements to get Oscar out of the country. He borrowed a yacht from a Member of Parliament, and had it lying at a port ready. He got Oscar one night into a carriage with a pair of fast-trotting horses, and started to drive him to the port, but Oscar absolutely refused to go. He wrote me a very touching letter giving his reasons for not going. It made me weep at the time, and even now I don't like to think of it. But I have thought since, 100 times, that it was an insane thing not to go, and that it would really have been a braver thing to do. Oscar said in his letter that he could not run away and hide and let down his bales. But my brother wanted him to go on my account, and Mr. Headlam would not have been affected in the least. He wrote, "A dishonoured name, a hunted life, and not for me, to whom you have been revealed on that high hill where beautiful things are transfigured." He also, pathetically, thought that he had a good chance of being acquitted at the second trial. If he had scrapped Sir Edward Clarke, defended himself, and called me as a witness, he might even then have had a sporting chance. But as things were, there was not the slightest hope for him. To the very last I urged him to go, and at the time when I wrote to him from Paris a letter which Harris gives in his book as an example of my heartlessness, chiefly, apparently, because I mentioned in the letter that I had with me young Charlie Hickey, a charming boy about a couple of years younger than myself, and well known to Oscar, a son of Colonel Hickey. I was expecting him to arrive in Paris to join me at any minute. Harris, in the new preface to the Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, explains that it was Ross who misrepresented the Hickey incident to him, and he expresses great regret for the injustice he did me. When Oscar got out on bail, he went with my brother to a hotel and took rooms. But my father, I blush to have to tell it of him, though his friend Sir Claude de Crespigny evidently thinks it is something to be proud of, went to the hotel and denounced Oscar to the manager, who promptly turned him out. He then went to his mother's house in Oakley Street, where his brother, Willie Wilde, took him in for the night. At this point, two Jews, not English, please observe, Mr. and Mrs. Ernest Leveson, offered to take him into their comfortable house in Courtfield Gardens. He remained in their house till his conviction. Mrs. Leveson, the Sphinx, as Oscar called her, and the name has stuck to her, is of course well known as a brilliant and witty writer. Both she and her husband showed on this occasion great courage and chivalry, and, I might add, Christian charity. People who live in this more tolerant, or at any rate less fiercely hypocritical, age can have no conception of the courage required in those days to be seen even speaking to Oscar Wilde, or having any association with him. Oscar wrote to me every day while he was out on bail, about 3 weeks, and I wrote every day to him. Where are the letters I wrote to him? I know that Ross, as I shall relate, stole, or conveyed, if you prefer the Falstaffian word, a large number of my letters. Any that were, or could be made to appear detrimental to me, or to reflect on my character, he used against me. But there must have been a great many others that would at any rate have shown how utterly devoted I was at that time to Oscar Wilde, and how completely I was ready to sacrifice my own interests, my safety, and even my honour to help him. As at the ransom trial, Ross's object was to show that I had abandoned Wilde, and deserted him, and ruined him, these letters were of course suppressed. "Where are they now?" I ask. When I won my action for libel against the Evening News in 1922, the jury added a rider to their verdict, expressing a strong opinion that my letters should be returned to me, or at least destroyed. My solicitors, Messrs. Carter and Bell, wrote to Messrs. Lewis and Lewis, and asked them if they intended to carry out the recommendation of the jury. Lewis and Lewis replied that the letters were not in their possession. Mr. Commins Carr, K.C., who was my counsel in this case, advised me that it would be possible for me to apply to the Chancery Court for an order, or injunction, enforcing the jury's recommendation. But my experience of Chancery Court judges gave me no kind of encouragement to expect anything at all from them except cynical injustice. Moreover, Mr. Carr pointed out to me that it really did not matter who had the letters, as, in view of the verdict I had obtained and the jury's rider, they could never be used against me again without disastrous results to those who use them. Consequently, I have never taken any steps to try to recover these letters. May I suggest now that it would be a graceful action on the part of someone, whoever he may be, to return them to me? Nothing could more serve to rehabilitate Wilde from a moral point of view than, if it were only possible, the publication of every single letter he ever wrote to me and every single letter that I ever wrote to him. As it is, just those few selected as damaging to us, first by my father and then by Robert Ross, have been produced. Those published would not amount to more than 5% of the whole lot we wrote to each other. I myself destroyed at least 150 letters of his to me, keeping only those which were comparatively colourless, all published in America by Mr. Andrews Clark. Of those I wrote to Wilde, which must be quite as numerous, only the few produced at the ransom trial by Ross have been given publicity. Ross had too strong a commercial instinct, unless I am very much mistaken, to have destroyed the rest. Again, I ask, where are they? And what prevents the person, whoever he may be, who now holds them, from returning them to me or making them public? The whole of this question regarding the property in letters might be held up as an example of what the English call un-English, but which I call typically English. The letters which Oscar Wilde wrote, and those which my father wrote to me, can be with impunity stolen and kept openly in the possession of persons and firms who make no secret of the fact that they keep them on purpose to use against me whenever occasion may arise or it may suit their convenience. Messrs. Charles Russell and Company, my father's solicitors, have several times brought Oscar Wilde's two letters to me, to which I have referred previously, into court against me, and they have had them framed and covered with glass. Why should these letters, which are my property, be in the possession of anyone but myself? The same applies to the whole manuscript of De Profundis, including the unpublished part. This is a letter written by Wilde in prison. It begins, Dear Bosie, and is signed, Your affectionate friend Oscar Wilde. Ross obtained possession of it and kept it, concealing all knowledge of it, for 12 years. He says in one of his prefaces that Wilde gave it to him on the day he left prison, but he has never attempted to explain why he did not send it on to me, or even send me a copy. In any case, the manuscript, which now reposes in the British Museum, and which is, of course, enormously valuable, really belongs to me. Why should the British Museum retain possession of my property? On the other hand, letters I wrote myself to my father, to Wilde, to Ross, and to others can be, and have been at different times, brought up against me in court, and can remain indefinitely in the hands of my enemies. Apparently, Wilde's letters to me and my father's letters to me belong to anyone who can manage to get hold of them, and the same applies to the letters I wrote with my own hand. End of chapter 18.